believe I have now webbed all of the recordings, so if you're interested, you can check on those. And following the usual policy, I am going to first ask if you have any questions on the stuff in family law and maybe say a few more words about that and then go on to tort law. So on the stuff that we did for the last couple of classes, anything you wanted to further discuss or any questions?
All right. Two things that I think are still worth thinking about that we discussed then. One of them is two related things. One of them is why people are against legalizing payments for adoption, and along similar lines, why people are so hostile to prostitution. Why that isn't just seen in a modern system, that you can see why people were hostile to it 150 years ago when non-marital sex was seen as sinful and wicked. But given that it's now seen as a perfectly legitimate activity, why does it suddenly become sinful and wicked when it's done for money? And then more generally, the question of why we have the strong prejudice we do against including money in what we think of as social interactions. Why we tend to give gifts instead of cash and gift cards instead of cash if we don't have any gifts suitable. Why we reciprocate for dinner invitations with restaurant dinner invitations instead of with offers of money. All of that stuff seems to be an interesting pattern of the world we live in. A lot of it exists inside our heads, and you can try to interrogate it there, and I suggest that it's sort of a fun thing to think about. All right, let me go on to tort law, and again, let me start by asking whether you have questions about the chapter you've read. Yes? Sure. Yeah, that's an old economic puzzle, and you can see why it's a puzzle, that we could do just fine without any diamonds. Well, not just fine, too good for scratching things because they're so hard, but just fine in other respects, whereas with no water we die in, what, about 2 or 3 days, I think. And the economist's answer depends on the distinction between marginal and average value. So let us suppose that this is quantity, number of gallons per day of water you are consuming. And I included consuming, flushing, and watering lawns and everything else. And marginal value shows how much you would be willing to pay for one more gallon. So if you were consuming no water at all, you'd be willing to pay an enormously high price for one more gallon. And that's because the first gallon you use for drinking, let's say. And the next gallon you would be using for washing up, which is also still pretty valuable. And then additional gallons for less and less valuable things. And way, way out here is the last gallon you use to water your lawn when it didn't really need watering. But you were playing safe. If the price of water were up here, you would buy only up to this point. You'd buy this quantity of water, and water would be very expensive and quite valuable. If the price of water is way down here, as it in fact is, you buy all the way out to this point, at which point your last gallon of water is worth very little to you. You pay very little for it. And you're getting a huge benefit because you're paying that same low price for this gallon and this gallon and this gallon and so forth. All right? This is what is called consumer surplus in economics. The fact that there is an area above price and below marginal value, which represents the fact that you're getting stuff for much less than you're worth. All right? So the answer is that diamonds, in contrast, have, let us suppose, a curve like that. But with the price up here, we consume very few diamonds, and those few diamonds are very valuable. And then that comes into the chapter when I'm looking at the paradoxical case of redundant causation, where you have two acts, each of which would cause the damage by itself. They both happen, and so I argue each of them is imposed no cost because each of them doesn't increase the cost of the other. And there is a real case which I think the web version of the book has a link to, which, if I remember correctly, involves fires.
that you've got a case where something is damaged by fire, and for some reason there are two different sources, like some accident starts a fire here and some accident starts a fire here, and the argument then is neither of those caused the damage because either fire by itself would have spread over them and done the damage. That's a very vague description and probably not right exactly, but I'm pretty sure it was fires. And obviously the story I'm telling for dramatic purposes in the chapter is a wildly implausible story because they have to not only both hit him but do it at the same instant, more or less. But I think it makes a more dramatic way of making the point, which is the two points which I actually make with regard to that particular instance, which will be relevant if any of you were ever teaching economics or maybe even other things. And one of them is that you can explain the idea in the most memorable way you can think of, because then your students remember it. And the other is that counterintuitive results are more educational than intuitive results, because then you have to actually think about them instead of saying, well, that's obviously true, so why do I have to look at his reasons why it's true? All right. Other questions from the chapter? All right, so a question you might want to think about, which we'll get back to in some weeks, is what I think of as the tort crime puzzle, which is why do we have these two very different legal mechanisms for dealing with what looks like about the same problem? And it was dramatized when O.J. Simpson was first acquitted of the crime of killing his wife and then convicted of the tort of killing his wife. In many cases, something would be treated only as a crime or only as a tort. In other cases, it might be treated as both. But then the question is, why have both systems? Why don't we just say that any time you do something bad to somebody, that's a tort, he can sue you for damages, and that's going to apply to burgling his house when you murder him, presumably his heirs are going to have to sue you for damages as well as for injuring the car. Or alternatively, why don't we have a system where when I damage your car, instead of suing me, you call the cops and you have me locked up in jail for 3 days as punishment for driving carelessly or something? And that's a question we'll come back to, but it strikes me as a question that for some reason law schools don't normally look at, and it sort of is central to the structure of the legal system we take for granted, and therefore I want to start you thinking about it now. And we will be in a later chapter, aside from discussing that question, we also have a chapter which looks at some other legal systems, including one in which killing somebody was a tort, treated as such. All right, I suggest in the chapter that there are really four questions that it's useful to ask about tort law. One is that tort damages are limited to wrongful acts in some sense or other. And I mentioned the example of competition, which injures the other party but is not tortious. There's a 15th century case which says so. The question of causation: what does it mean to say that my act caused your injury? The question of liability: under what circumstances is the person who is held to have caused something liable? And then the final question of how much, since the normal tort suit is for damages, what determines how much the damages are? And I think it's sort of useful to think about the logic of tort law in terms of those four categories. So why isn't competition a tort? It's really a two-word answer in terms of what we discussed much earlier. Pecuniary externality is the term I was thinking of. Yes, because my competition results in my competitor being poorer, but our customers being richer. And I run through some imaginary numbers on that in the chapter, but the basic argument is that the loss is not a net loss. It's only a transfer between other people. It's therefore a pecuniary externality. Pecuniary externalities you do not want to deter, since they're doing no damage. If my action imposes a net benefit to me of a dollar, a cost to you of $10, and a benefit to you of $10, then my $1 is a correct measure of the net effect, even though I'm ignoring the effects on both of you. The next one is causation. And that one is sort of fun, because causation is something we think we understand until we start thinking about it. And then you start thinking about it, and it becomes very, very unclear what causation really means. So any reactions on my coincidental causation case, right? Say falls on somebody, is it clear both in what sense I did cause it and in what sense I didn't? Anybody? Nobody? What? I don't know. I'm trying to find out. When the reaction I'm asking a question is people try to read the book, I assume they don't yet know if they're confused about it. So,
I think it's one of those.
What?
Causation was like one of those things drilled in you and sort of odd. It was like.
How many of these? I'm curious because, of course, I've never been to law school.
You have students who'd ask a million, like, at least in my tour class that I took last year.
Yep.
Everyone thought of every example under the sun, past the professor, and gets old after a while, yep. I guess.
So yeah, well, not having taken a tort case class.
You walk in and you might know that the safe's there, and you stop the guy.
Yep. So you're assuming that people have all already thought these questions through. Good. And it is clear, A, that you did cause it in the but-for sense, but that you did not cause it in the foreseeability sense. That you didn't check the changing ex ante probability, which is all we really care about. What about my redundant causation? That was what you were asking about the diamond water, which is really the same issue. Do I convince people that the damage done by each of the two hunters to the third hunter is zero?
I understood that part, and I read through it three times, trying to understand it. But as far as the putting a value to the incentives of all the parties,
yes,
I was slightly confused by that.
All right. The
explain that.
Sure. Under the assumptions, if one person, I don't remember the name, but they're A, B, and C anyway. If A alone hunts, there's a 0.1 chance he will kill C. All right? If B alone hunts, there's a 0.1 chance he will kill C. If A and B hunt, what is the chance that C will die? You should be able to figure it out when I look up my answer.
0.09?
No,
the chance that they both shoot him.
What? No. 0.2. Really? 0.19, because two bullets, if they both hit him, he only dies once. Right? Isn't there a movie or something, you only die once?
You only live twice? Yeah, that's not how James Bond's good.
Anyway. So, if both of them do it, it's 0.19, because there is a 0.1 chance that you kill him, a 0.1 chance that you kill him, but that includes the 0.01 chance that both of you killed him. So it's a 0.09 chance that your bullet killed him, a 0.09 chance that your bullet killed him, and a 0.01 chance that both of your bullets killed him. Right? So therefore, in terms of A's incentive, if B isn't hunting, how much of a disincentive? C's life is worth $1 million somehow. If we know that B is homesick, what cost is A imposed by hunting? That's right. And under the rule where single bullets are liable, he'll pay that on average. Ditto if A is homesick and B is. If A is out there hunting and B says, should I go hunting too? That increases the probability from 0.1 to 0.19. So the increase in the risk to C is 0.09. The expected cost of that is 90,000, since that's 0.09 times a million. And B indeed stands to pay an expected loss of 90,000. Because under the rule I am proposing, he will only be found liable for a single bullet death, and there's a 0.09 chance that he will shoot C and A won't. All right? So that means that the deterrent cost to B is indeed equal to the expected damage due to his decision to go hunting, and therefore B has the right incentive. All right? Make sense? Yes? No? People still puzzled by something there?
So if B knows that A is hunting, then B's risk is $90,000, right?
So, okay. Then both the risk B is imposing and the expected liability damages paid by B are $90,000. So the number.
times you want it equal.
So one would be more likely to go hunting on the day the other hunting.
Which is right, because after all, on the day that the other person is hunting, the chance that you will kill someone is a little bit less, because there's a chance that they're already dead when your bullet hits them. It sounds bizarre, and yet the logic is right, whether or not the conclusions are right. For clear thinking, you need to separate out those two questions. That is, if your argument is right, is a question of the internal logic of it, is the conclusion it leads to right? Well, there might be some other argument that undercuts it, as there not uncommonly is.
So if there's a rule where the 1% chance that both bullets hit, there's no liability, then we would expect to see more hunters.
But only the right number of more hunters.
Okay.
That is, you would then get just the right number of hunters so far as this example gives it. And then, as I suggest, there are a few problems wrong with that as an actual legal rule. One of them is it's assuming that it was an accident, that if you really have that legal rule, and if you imagine a system where you have only tort damages for killing, leave out murder investigations and such, then A and B make sure that they shoot him at the same time. Because, both of them are courting C, or maybe courting C's wife, or maybe C is a rival in business or something like that. Some reason. So that's one problem. And the other problem is that we can't assume with confidence that A and B can each pay $1 million fine. And if they can't pay $1 million fine, then we would like other ways of deterring them. And one way of deterring them is to say, in the double bullet case, we'll punish you. That is an incentive not to do the sort of things that frequently lead to single bullet cases, even though in this particular case it didn't. So that's then like punishing the guy for attempted murder, which also did no harm. So that sense, these two arguments really link to different parts of the course of the discussion of the ideas. Yeah?
Could you talk a little bit about this distinction between marginal damage and average damage?
Sure.
Having trouble flagging that.
Sure. It's like what I was doing there, because what's happening is that the marginal damage is the increased damage due to my contribution in this case, due to having two hunters instead of one. That marginal damage is 0.09. The average damage, on the other hand, is 0.1. No, 0.9. I'm wrong. The average damage is 0.095, because he was killed with probability 0.19, and there are two of us, so half of that would be 0.095. All right?
So the
marginal damage is zero. I'm wrong. The marginal damage from hunting is 0.09. The marginal damage in the particular case where I hit him when the other guy hit him is zero. Right? In the double bullet case, the marginal damage from each bullet is zero.
Sure.
Aside from maybe you've got to pay the mortician a little bit more to tidy up the body. So the marginal damage is zero in the double bullet case. The marginal damage of my hunting is a 0.09 probability of a single bullet kill, marginal damage $1 million, and a 0.01 probability of a double bullet kill, marginal damage zero. All right so far?
Yeah.
And so in the double bullet case, he's still dead. So the average damage done by the two bullets is $500,000 each. All right, it's $1 million life. But given each bullet, the other bullet did no damage. So that's the marginal versus average distinction.
So when we're creating a tort liability rule, we're trying to go after average damage.
No, we're trying to go after marginal. Just as in ordinary economics, you would like a system where the price of a product is equal to its marginal cost of production, because that means that anybody to whom the value of the good is at least as great as the cost of having one more such good exist will get it. All right? Does that make sense? Sorry. That's all right. It's worth thinking about things. I mean, these aren't intuitive. But
what is it? I understand the logic of the marginal average distinction. I kind of hung up a little bit on Carl, this disease, the guy who got infected, shot his incentive structure to go out right? Is the compensation for his death.
That's an interesting point. You're right. This is a general point with using tort damages instead of fines, that now, since Carl will be fully compensated, assuming he cares for his wife enough so that $1 million to her counts as $1 million to him, since he's going to be fully compensated, the fact that his going hunting raised the probability from zero, his being killed from zero to 0.19, does not affect his behavior and should. And that's why a fully efficient system would, for example, fine them rather than making it a tort damage, or use a negligence rule or in some other way. That's one of the issues I get to halfway through the chapter is the dual causation problem, which is the old Coasean problem of things being caused by both people and ways of dealing with that. But at this point, I'm ignoring that. C is just going hunting. C, we're not worried about C's incentives. We should be. But we'll just assume C doesn't like his wife very much, and therefore the compensation to her is worth nothing to him, so now he's got the right incentive too. So it's clear that liking your wife results in inefficient economic behavior. Right. Any other? Going back to this marginal versus average thing for a moment, think about the other side of that in terms of wages. Imagine that you are somebody who gets really bored if all you do is play computer games and read novels and chat with your friends. And you'd really rather have a job, even if you weren't paid. You'd rather have a job as long as the job didn't take more than, 4 hours a day, 3 days a week. That would be enough to make you feel as though you're busy and enjoying yourself, and then you'll appreciate the rest of the time doing things you like. In fact, the employers want to hire you for 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, and to do that, they have to pay you $20 an hour. Well, for that first 12 hours you're contributing, you're getting paid $20 an hour for work you do for free. Right? So that's a case where the average the marginal cost to you of the last hour is $20, which is why they've got to pay that much to get you to work a full 40-hour week. But the average cost is something less than that. You don't know what, but something between 20 and zero. And you're being paid the marginal, and that's why you have producer surplus. All right, producer surplus. I guess I didn't go through that in this course. I went through it in another course I was doing. But central ideas in economics in general, not law and econ in particular, that's the demand curve. That's the price you can buy something at. You buy this quantity. This unit up here was worth that much. You paid that much, so your gain on it is that height times the width of one unit. The next one is this. So that means that this whole area represents the amount by which what you buy was worth more than what you paid for it, because you were able to buy all of it at the cost which represented the value of the last unit. All right? Now let's try a supply curve. This is your supply curve for labor, let us suppose. And let us imagine that at a wage of zero, you'd still be able to willing to work a while just for the fun of it. You've got a supply curve like that, and at $20 an hour, you work 40 hours a week. Well, this first 12 hours, you're getting paid that same $20 an hour for stuff you do for nothing. Maybe you'd even pay to do it, in which case you're getting an even larger benefit. If you say, let's just suppose it's here, that this is your supply curve. So this whole chunk, 12 hours times 20, that you're making $240 profit, not profit in the sense of what you're getting minus the cost due of your leisure, essentially. And similarly, all the rest of this, so all of that is producer surplus. What?
I agree.
I don't know how many of you have had this stuff in economics before, but these are very powerful tools if you think about it, because people want to somehow say, well, your benefit is how much you're paid. But that's obviously wrong, because you've got to give up something to get that pay. Or, yeah.
So in law and econ in general,
yeah.
Are we particularly concerned with the distribution of any sort of consumer or supplier surplus? Or is it just along?
I don't know what law and econ in general means. If the question you're asking, which stems from the Posner conjecture, is what rules are economically efficient,
since our definition of economic efficiency counts a dollar to anybody as the same thing, we don't care about distribution. But law and economics in general could also include somebody who was an egalitarian who wanted to use law and economics to figure out how to get what he thought was a more just distribution of income, and being him, it would matter. So, but for the economic efficiency kinds of arguments, we don't care about distribution. What we do care about, however, is costs associated with distribution, such as the cost of adjusting the distribution. For example, my investments on learning to pick pockets in order to readjust the distribution in my favor. That's a legitimate consideration because that's a net cost. All right? All right, the next one is probabilistic causation. And that's relevant to a variety of questions, including later on to punitive damages. So how do you think we ought to handle my hypothetical reactor case? The reactor, we will imagine, raises the long-run incidence of cancer from 10 cases per 10,000 people to 11 cases per 10,000 people. And the question is, should the reactor be liable in tort? And if so, on what? What should the rules be?
Okay, I like the pooling the pulling the
pooling the plaintiffs.
Pulling the plaintiffs together.
Yeah, I don't know if there are any such real cases. This struck me as a sort of a cute way of doing it.
And I guess in reality all these problems is there's massive transaction costs involved.
And the excuse for the way tort law does it, essentially, is that we don't have the kind of detailed information that you need. We don't really know probabilities. And that just as one of the points I make in my other class is that one of the things that accounting and tort law have in common is that all probabilities are one or zero. That if you're doing accounts and the company is being sued and you believe there's a 30% chance that it'll lose $1 million, you write that down as a liability of zero. If you believe there's a 60% chance it'll lose $1 million, you write that as a liability of $1 million. So the normal rule in accounting is that if it's more likely than not, you treat it as it's going to happen. If it's less likely than not, as if it's not going to happen. And that's exactly the tort law normal rule. If it's more likely than not, you treat it as if it were certain. And if it's less likely, as if it's not, if it's zero. And in both cases, it seems to me that the basic argument is that of course this would be wrong in a world of perfect free information, but that as I see it, the rules of accounting are largely designed to reduce the amount of discretion an accountant has. Because if accountants have discretion, the accountants are working for somebody who wants the books to look one way or another, and the more discretion they have, the less information they're really going to reveal. And I think that explains why accounting has a bunch of clearly unrealistic rules, which, however, give unambiguous results. So that, for example, with a few special exceptions, assets are all priced at what you paid for them, even if it's land you bought 50 years ago that everybody knows is worth 10 times as much. And assets that you never paid for are treated as zero, even if they consist of a reputation or a trade name or something that's worth a fortune. But that same thing, that same trade name, if you bought it from another firm, now you can list it at what you paid for it. So I think in that sense, it's sort of an interesting similarity between tort law and accounting rules, and both of them are ways of dealing with worlds of where information isn't very readily available. And in the accounting case, you've got one kind of bias you're worried about. In the tort case, each party is trying to prove numbers its way, and you can have an awful lot of litigation over whether it's a 40% or a 45% chance, and most real-world cases you don't really know. One of the other things I discuss in that course later on is statistics, and a lot of people misunderstand the meaning of statistical results. And a lot of people think that the result of statistics is to tell you how likely it is that something is true. And ordinary statistics never gives you that information. Ordinary statistics tells you how likely it is that the evidence for this being true would be as good as it were if this is false. That's not at all the same thing as how likely this is true. Does that distinction make any sense to people or not? I'm talking about things like confidence intervals that you see in statistics all the time, and people think a 1-0 result means there's only a 10% chance that your theory isn't true. And that's not what it means at all. It means that if your theory is false in a particular way, there's only a 10% chance that the evidence for it would be as good as it is. But after all, if you start out with the belief that your theory is almost certainly false, then the combined probability, A, of its being false, and by chance of getting pretty good evidence for it, becomes higher than the combined probability of being true and getting good evidence for it. So, I'm not sure if people are reacting. This doesn't have much to do with law and econ, but it's a fact that you'll have to deal with in your life that a large majority of people don't understand and think they understand, and therefore I wanted to sort of warn you about it. But anyway, discuss that more if people want to at some point. All right, so if we're probabilistic, as I say, we've got this problem, and I suggest several possible ways of dealing with it. And of course, the way tort law mostly deals with it is just say, well, it's not shown by preponderance of the evidence, no liability. All right. Next question is how. Yeah.
Sorry, one more question. On the percentage thing.
Don't apologize. I'd rather talk about things people actually want to talk about.
It seems that if you have a. Because of transaction cost problems, it seems that if you have, increased 9% of this area, it seems that having some sort of fine system might be less costly.
That would be an alternative, absolutely. An alternative is that some government agency has fines for imposing such risks, and that would be
distribution. Then, if you want to compensate people for it, might that become a
yeah? But what I argue later on in the chapter is that it's a mistake to think of tort law as an insurance system. That just because it's a very poor insurance system. That as I think I may have commented earlier, the tort damages is really playing three different roles at once. One of them is compensation insurance, which I think is a poor way of doing, but it does do some of that. One of them is deterrence to the tortfeasor, and one of them is bounty to the victim to get the tortfeasor convicted. So that if you think about it, in a way, you would think of tort law as like criminal law with bounties, in which if you bring the guy in along with the evidence, we'll give you $1,000. Well, if you bring in the evidence to a court as a plaintiff, and you win the case, he has to give you $1,000. Yep.
So in the case of class actions, you're basically, could you characterize that as like an extreme bounty system where the bounty really goes to
the lawyer?
In most cases, goes to the lawyer, but
that's right.
It's sort of like a legislatively crafted alternative to administrative regulation.
I don't know how much of it is legislative and how much judicial, but yes.
Yeah.
But no, I agree. You could certainly think of that as really being a bounty system. I think there may be better ways of doing it. We'll discuss that later.
Yeah.
But it obviously has some problems. But insofar as there's a good argument for it, I think the argument really is that it gives somebody an incentive to detect this particular kind of tort and do something about it. So the first question is, how many accidents should we have? What's an efficient number of auto deaths? Anybody want to tell me? In principle, how do we discover what's an efficient number of auto deaths?
Where the cost of the accident is no more than the cost of getting prevented, or less.
That is, if you prevent all accidents where the cost of preventing them is no more than the value of preventing them, then you've got the efficient level. So the sort of thing that makes many people think badly of economists is the idea that we say there is an optimal number of auto deaths, but of course what we mean by that is a number such as getting a lower cost more than it's worth. Which is surely true, since we know that we can get it to zero by banning automobiles. And very few people, there are probably a few people in favor of that, but very few people are in favor of that. Turns out, by the way, that in Europe, which is usually seen as sort of the home of public transportation, it's still the case that most trips are actually by cars. Right. So then the question is, how do we get the efficient quantum number of accidents? And the early case, the easy case, is the unicausal accident, the accident where only one party's actions affect its probability, if there are any such. And I run through the argument for why both strict liability and negligence work for that. And you should be warned that when I say negligence, I'm speaking as a law and econ person. We have a definition of negligence. Arguably, Hand has the same definition of negligence, but it is dubious that most courts have the same definition of negligence. All right, so the economist's definition of negligence is failing to take all cost-justified precautions, all the precautions where the benefit of the precaution was at least as large as the cost. So do people follow why strict liability gives you the right result for unicausal accidents? Is that all clear or not? We've been here before. What is strict liability in terms of the first half of the course? I cause a damage. I must pay the amount of that damage. What do we call that? Anybody?
Is there property?
What?
Property.
No, we call it a liability rule. But that wasn't what I meant. Before we even got into the law, we're just talking about economics. What do we call a rule which says if I impose a cost on you, I will have to pay the amount of that cost? It's called a Pigouvian tax. Right? Effluent fee. Pigouvian tax. Same idea. All right? So strict liability says I caused a certain amount of damage. I will have to pay that amount of damage. Therefore, in my deciding what acts to take, I will take into account the cost to you as well as the cost to me. That's Pigou's proposal. I have no idea whether it occurred to Pigou that tort law fit that description or not, but certainly it occurred to Coase and various other people since then. So that's one way of looking at it. What about negligence? Negligence rule says I have to pay you the damage if I didn't take all cost-justified precautions. Do you see why in a fully informed world that gives the same result? Strict liability, I will take all cost-justified precautions. I've just reached that result. What will I do under a negligence rule?
Take all those precautions.
This is a fully informed court. What will I do?
Take
all cost-justified precautions. Because if I don't, I'm in a strict liability world, and then I do. And if I do, I do. All right? So, therefore, in that world, you get the same result from both, and the only difference is that strict liability, you have more law cases, but less to prove in each case, basically. But other than that, not very interesting. But then we get into the point you were about to get into, which is this assumes the court knows whether I took all cost-justified precaution, but the court never knows that. Because while the court may know that I got my brakes checked, the court doesn't know that the reason I ran into your car was that I was thinking about the reply I was going to make to the absurd argument about Adam Smith that somebody today made on Usenet, rather than thinking about my driving. Since I could have postponed those thoughts, arguably, until I got home and was in a position to answer him on Usenet, I was being negligent, but the court doesn't know that. All right? But on the other hand, under a strict liability regime, it's in my interest to say, well, yes, I'd like to think about exactly how I'm going to word my withering response to his post, but how about paying attention just for another 5 or 10 minutes to what I'm doing in order that I don't raise anybody? All right? So with some unobservable precautions, now strict liability gives me an incentive to take the efficient level of all precautions. Negligence liability gives me an incentive to take the efficient level of the observable precautions, and whatever level of the unobservable precautions is privately optimal but not socially optimal. All right, everybody following that? I can't tell if you don't say anything. All right, so far we're fine. And it's worth mentioning that unobservable precautions are often referred to as activity level, and the grounds for that is that one way of preventing auto accidents is not to drive or to drive less, and while the court can know that I was driving and I couldn't have run into you if I wasn't, it can't know if it was efficient for me to drive because that would require information about the value to me of that particular trip that a court is unlikely to have. All right? And we then get what I think is one of Posner's more ingenious ideas, which is an explanation of strict liability for ultra-hazardous activities. Because what does this logic tell us? Well, we've just run through for the unicausal case, what is the kind of case for which we would have a strong advantage to strict liability, given the argument just made? That's right. When important precautions, when the precautions that most likely you should have taken are not observable. And then what does Posner say? Posner says, well, what is an ultra-hazardous activity? It's an activity where even if you do it carefully, it's very dangerous. For example, keeping a pet lion or blowing up sumps with dynamite. Well, if even when you do it carefully, it's very dangerous, then it is quite likely that the precaution you ought to be taking is not doing it at all. So that suggests that it makes sense that strict liability for ultra-hazardous activities. And in my view, at least, that's one of Posner's hints. It's one of the ones where he really makes a legitimate point that does support his general line of analysis. All right? So far, we're fine. And the flip side of that is that if we're reasonably sure that the unobservable precautions are not worth taking, then we can use negligence and we're just fine. And that, I argued, was the Annie Lee Turner versus Big Lake Oil case, where what the court says is, I don't know if you read the chunk where I discussed that before, but I don't think it was assigned. It was the chunk where I was sort of summarizing the legal system for non-law student types. But Annie Lee Turner, the point I was making there is this is a Texas case. And the Texas court is citing British common law decisions of, I think, the 19th century, maybe 19th. And that, in explaining sort of the common law, you know, this seems a little bizarre because Britain, not only does Britain now have no authority over Texas, Britain never had any authority over Texas. It wasn't even a British colony. And yet it matters, and that's because of the nature of the common law, which common law judges think they're discovering, and therefore the discovery by experts in another country 100 years earlier is still relevant to think about. And the British case found strict liability for bursting reservoirs. So you have somebody who is holding water in a reservoir at his property, the reservoir breaks, damage is done, and the British case said, that's strict liability, we don't have to show that you were negligent. And the Texas case says, that may be a perfectly good rule for England, but in West Texas, whether or not you store water in reservoirs is not optional. All right, we're in a desert. We engage in agriculture, and no reasonable person is going to say, because of the risk of bursting reservoirs, we're not going to have any. Therefore, they say we ought to have negligence liability rather than strict liability, because we don't want to push the activity level. It's not going to move. If we make them strict liability, there will be the same number of reservoirs as if we don't, he's really saying. We're very close to the same number. So we're not going to get any substantial shift towards more efficient behavior by strict liability. Therefore, use negligence instead. All right? So far we're fine. Now we get to the Coasean world that we really live in which accidents are jointly caused by both parties. And now the problem is that with strict liability, it is true that the person who is thought of as the tortfeasor has just the right incentive to avoid the accident, but the person who's thought of as the victim has no incentive at all to avoid the accident, assuming that strict liability really fully compensates. And a lot of discussion of ignoring the fact that although the tort rule is supposed to be make whole, it's dubious that real tort law as practically applied does make whole. But supposing it does for purposes of our current analysis, now you've got no incentive to avoid being a victim, and in cases where your behavior is relevant, where the reason he ran you down was partly that he was driving a bit too fast, and partly that you were walking in dark clothing at night down the street and got hit. So now we have a problem with strict liability. And now, as long as all precautions are observable, negligence provides what looks like a very elegant solution to this problem. Because people follow why negligence gives the incentive to both parties. Right, sort of almost like a card trick. That under a negligence rule, we've already seen that the person who's considered the tortfeasor will never be held negligent because he will never choose to be negligent. This is perfectly informed at this point. Since he's he has an incentive to take the efficient precautions under the negligence rules we already showed. Since he takes the efficient precautions, he's not negligent. Since he's not negligent, the victim is not going to get compensated because it's going to lose the suit because we've got negligence liability. Therefore, the victim bears the cost of the accident. Therefore, the victim has an incentive to take four precautions. All right? Is that... It's really quite a cute act. I wish I'd thought about it myself, but I didn't. Somebody else thought about the question. But it's a neat little argument. But then, of course, and I've sort of simplified the problem with my cars and tanks, which is a little unrealistic because even with cars and tanks, the cars will sometimes run into each other. I don't know if I actually put it on the webpage. At some point when I was in Europe, I noticed in Germany road signs where there's a sign which is a picture of a tank, which presumably means tanks sometimes use this road. And I was thinking I ought to have that on that in that chapter, and I may have actually gotten around to putting it on the web version. I'm not sure. But anyway, but in my stylized story where cars only run into tanks and tanks are never injured, and we know that we will think of the tank as the tortfeasor, seems sort of plausible under the circumstances, in that story, if all relevant precautions are observable, now negligence liability makes both sides behave correctly. All right? And now when some of the precautions are not observable, what do we get? That everyone is correct on the observable precautions, but the tanks take an inefficiently low level of observable precautions. They drive when they shouldn't. All right? Further point, which may or may not be obvious, is the symmetry of the situation. The fact that no liability and strict liability are really the same rule. The only difference is that in one of them, the cost is always borne by the tank, and the other, it's always borne by the car. That in either of them, one party, depending on what anybody does, bears the cost. And they have the same result, except that the roles of the two parties. The situation is, in a sense, symmetrical, in as much as both parties' actions affect what happens. It's asymmetrical in the sense that the cost starts out on the car, because if the one gets crushed, but then if we ask not where does it start, but where does it end, it's again symmetrical that one rule, it always ends on the tank. One rule, it always ends on the car. And then their incentives correspond accordingly. And the other pair of rules are negligence and strict liability with contributory negligence, which, again, are really the same rules, just the rules are reversed. That strict liability with contributory negligence is just like negligence liability for cars. Because if the car is negligent, he pays. If he's not negligent, the other side pays. All right? So... Hence, my four things are really two things. All right. And that then suggests, if you're actually building rules, that the kind of question you want to ask is, for which kind of party in these accidents are observable versus unobservable precautions important? And you would like to use negligence if you know that cars take lots of unobservable precautions and tanks take very few unobservable precautions, then a straight negligence rule will give you the right result. If it was the other way around, you would want strict liability with contributory negligence. All right. Let me now get to the real solution to this, which I invented for myself, but I admit that I then discovered that Earl Thompson had invented it for himself, and many other people, I'm sure, had invented it for themselves, and that's what I thought of as double liability, namely both sides pay the full amount. So that when my tank runs over your car, you don't get anything, so you got to pay for fixing your car, and I pay a fine to the state equal to the damage done to your car, which I thought of as double liability, and Earl called it something else, but anyway. And that looks like a really elegant solution because now each of us has the right incentive to prevent the accident. And what's the bug in the honey? What's the problem with that solution? The obvious problem is accidents never get reported. Now, strictly speaking, in a zero transaction world, there's the further problem, which we've discussed before in a different context, of too much incentive. Because in a zero-transaction world, I pay the tank to take precautions, and he pays me to take precautions, because our summed loss is twice the damage done. Right?
Yeah.
So I, the driver, pay the tank to take precautions, because if he does run over me, I'm going to have to replace my car. He pays me to take precautions, because if he does run over me, he'll have to pay for my car, and you therefore get an inefficient high level. That was the coast plus Pagoo is too much from a long time ago, showing up back again. But that's not very plausible in this story with lots of tanks and lots of cars. But the obvious problem is that nobody reports it, and that we've really changed it from tort law back to some version of criminal law. And that also that suggests an advantage to criminal law. In fact, I think I've got it. I think it's in this book, but maybe somewhere else, where I was showing that on that basis, some of the things that we treat as crimes ought to be torts, and some of the things we treat as torts ought to be crimes, because of the effect on the incentive of the victim. Then the final question, which moves us a little bit closer to reality, is why has anybody ever found negligent? Because I've just proved that no one will ever be negligent, right? That's part of the logic of why this system works. And now you will really be negligent in unobservable precautions, but since they're unobservable, the court can't find you negligent for them. And there you've got to start dropping your assumption that everybody knows stuff. You've got to say, well, maybe the court's wrong. Maybe its estimate of what level of precaution you should take is too high or too low. Maybe the court's right, but you're wrong. You thought that what you were doing was the efficient level of precaution, and it wasn't. Maybe the court is right, but the court's not right about you. That the court doesn't have your detailed information, so the court is analyzing it in terms of the average driver. You're either a better or worse than average driver, and if you're a better than average driver, then it might be that the optimal thing to do is what they consider negligent, because you say, even if I do that, it's true if there's an accident that I'll be liable, but because I'm such a good driver, there's not going to be an accident, and therefore why do I care if I'm liable? All right, that would be the extreme case in one direction, and if that's literally true, you wouldn't be found liable. But if you imagine not that there won't be an accident, but it's very, very unlikely enough, so that I would rather be liable when it happens and be able to drive at the 75 miles an hour that I think is safe than hold down to 60 and not be liable. That would give you some negligence cases. Some people would be found negligent. And one of the harder problems, as it were, that I'm sort of mostly avoiding is, as you start dropping your perfect assumption, your perfect information assumptions, how does the law change? That's not always at all. And one implication of this is that if the people in question vary a lot, that has the same effect as unobservable precautions. It really means that precautions are unobservable because you don't know whether for this person what was the right level of precaution. So that, and I didn't think of any examples, maybe some of you can, but I was thinking therefore that would suggest, just as with Posner's argument ultra hazardous, that if you had some case where the potential tortfeasors varied a whole lot in what precautions they ought to take, that would again be a reason for strict liability instead of negligence liability. All right. So far, so good. Any questions so far? All right. Next question is the amount of damages. And we have a number of problems there. One problem is that although it looks like a Pigouvian rule, it isn't really the right Pigouvian rule, first because the probability is not one. All right, so we don't have probability multipliers in tort law. Even if we discover by research that only half of the tortfeasors get sued and lose, we still only get damages, not double damages. All right. A further problem is the issue of lawyers' costs. That the real deterrence to me as the tortfeasor, putting aside the probability, is more than the damage paid, because in the process of trying to keep the damage down and trying to lower the chance that I'll lose the case, I got to spend money on lawyers, and therefore my real deterrence is higher. Now this is a little tricky, because if you really worked it through, you should say yes, but given that system, when I drive dangerously, I'm not only imposing on you the cost of a dented car, I'm also imposing on both of us the cost of paying for lawyers. So you really want to think that through a little more carefully. I do, in fact, think through the equivalent of that in the criminal case in the next chapter, where
You want to think about the right incentive, taking account of the fact that there are costs to deterring things. And that's a fairly substantial issue. So the sort of the short version of that story, which we'll get again in a longer version in criminal law, is that the sort of first approximation for both criminal and civil law is damages equal to damage done. That's the Pigouvian rule. And in the case of criminal law, where we expect that we'll catch much less than 100% of the criminals, it is damages times probability equal to damage done. All right, do people follow that basic argument? Sure. We want the first approximation is to say you should not drive dangerously unless the benefit to you of driving dangerously is more than the cost to others. So we'll impose on you the cost to others. That's the Pigouvian rule. So if we are sure that if you drive dangerously you will be caught, sued, and lose, then the damage is the amount of damage you do to the other party. All right. Similarly, in criminal law, we could say we only want you to commit a crime if the benefit to you is more than the cost to the victim. How do we do that? Well, if only half the criminals are caught, we impose a fine for the crime that's twice the damage done, and now you'll only do it if your benefit is more than the damage done. That's the first approximation. It's wrong. It's right for the first approximation, but the reason it's wrong is that catching and punishing people is costly. And it's costly both in criminal and in tort law. In tort law, that's mostly litigation cost. In criminal law, it's mostly litigation cost because in tort law, the usual punishment is a fine that we call a damage payment, and that's just a transfer of cash. It's costly in criminal law, not only because of the cost of litigation, but because of the cost of apprehension. We've got to pay the wages of the cops. And because many of the penalties are expensive penalties. Penalties like imprisonment or execution, which, unlike a fine, nobody gets what the criminal loses. All right. And in the case of imprisonment, somebody's got to pay for what the criminal is, as it were. So once we recognize that, we say, well, the right rule is not damage punishment equal to damage done. The right rule is that level of punishment at which the cost of deterring one more offense is just equal to the damage done by that one more offense. And then what's the cost of deterring an offense? Well, that's a little tricky, because you deter an offense by raising the probability or the punishment, or both. And raising the probability in the criminal case is going to require hiring more cops. Raising the probability in the tort case might require lower standards of proof or something similar, which would have problems. And raising the amount of damages in the criminal case may mean you're more likely to have to lock him up instead of fine him, or lock him up for longer. And in the tort case, what is the cost associated with raising the amount of the damage payment? It's a cash transfer, so it's not a punishment cost. But what is the cost that goes up when you raise the amount of damages that you're willing to pay for a tort? An issue of some professional interest to you in a few years. What do you think is one of the striking differences between a tort suit for $1,000 and a tort suit for $100,000? What?
Legal fees?
Yeah, sure. It's going to be relevant to you. You'd much rather be the lawyer either defending or prosecuting a $100,000 claim than a $1,000 claim. And because the $100,000, both parties are willing to spend a lot more money because there's much more at stake. So in the case of tort law, if you raise the damage payment, you would raise the costs via an increase, higher litigation costs. Right? So in both cases, as you raise the punishment, you raise the apprehension plus punishment, litigation, that whole set of costs per offense. All right. But what's the other thing that happens when you raise the punishment? What's the reason you want to raise the punishment? That's right, to deter offenses, exactly. So that means that raising punishment might either increase or decrease your total cost of catching and trying people. Because it raises the cost per offense, but it raises the number of offenses. So if you had a case where, again, it could be criminal or tort, the logic is really the same. If you have a case where raising the punishment a little bit cuts the number of offenses in half, then the marginal cost of deterrence is negative. It costs you less
to have an enforcement system that leaves you with 100 offenses the moment, leaves you with 200 offenses. Does that make sense? But if that's the case, then you would like to over-deter. Because after all, if you deter an offense, you don't have to try it. So you would say, here is a tort where the cost of preventing the tort to the tortfeasor is $100. And the damage done is $90. So our analysis so far says we don't want to prevent that. That's an efficient tort. But if we follow the obvious rule of having a $90 tort damages make the victim whole, the tort occurs, the victim sues, the victim collects his $90, and by the time it's over, the victim and the tortfeasor have each spent $20 on lawyer fees. So the result of that tort occurring is a $100 saving to the tortfeasor who didn't have to prevent it, a $90 loss to the victim who was the victim of it, and a $40 cost to the two of them for lawyers. We'd be better off deterring it. We'd be better off having the tort damage be $110, even though that's more than the damage done, because then that one doesn't occur. Of course, that means that some of the ones that do occur will now be more expensive with the higher damages. Just a minute. All right, let me go from that point, which, as I say, we'll get to again in criminal law, where I go through the math a little more carefully, and ask a different question, which is why the damage should go to the victim. That is, given that this is a way of deterring offenses, we've got one answer already, so he has an incentive to report it. Now, of course, you could have a system where there was a fine for committing a tort, and the money collected by the fine went to whoever reported the tort. That's a standard bounty system. So it's a reason, and you can say, well, the victim is the person most likely to be in a position to report it, but it's not clear it's an adequate reason. Can you see other reasons why it might make sense to have the victim the person who gets the claim rather than somebody else? In tort law.
Did you already address giving an incentive?
An incentive to report it?
Yeah.
And to prosecute it. That is, someone has to have an incentive to prosecute it, so that you can think of it as an incentive to both report and prosecute. Why would we rather have it the victim than someone else? Yeah.
Another thing is, I think a victim would know better what the cost,
what the damage done was.
What the damage done was relative to the cost of prosecuting.
So he would have some additional information. The victim also has another incentive to prosecute, which is that he would like to deter offenses against himself, and a reputation for suing people who hurt you is going to be worth something for the next guy who might be careless to him. It depends, of course, on the nature of the tort, but if you think of those torts where I know who the potential victim is. So all of that suggests that having it be the victim rather than some random person who's got the right to do it has, furthermore, the victim is likely to be an important witness. If there were three different people, the person who got to the police first with news of the tort, the person who wanted to deter the tort because he was the victim, and the person who was the witness, then you'd have to have various transactions among them to get them all into one group in order to sue. This solves that problem. Can you see the one great disadvantage to having, we've got one disadvantage, is that it reduces the incentive to take precautions. You see the other and somewhat less obvious, maybe important, more important disadvantage to having the victim be the person who collects the money. How do we find out how much the damage was? That is to say, it means that your most important witness can't be trusted. Because your important witness is the victim, he's going to collect the money, so he has an obvious incentive both to inflate the damages as best he can, and in addition to inflating the damages, to, if he can, lie about the negligence of the other party if it's a negligence case. And by his own negligence, obviously, to understate that. So we have advantages, but also disadvantages. And this is a not uncommon situation in this, that the world is not so tidily arranged that one set of rules works in all ways and doesn't work, or doesn't work in all ways.
All right, let me go on to the case of punitive damages, which is a bit of a controversial issue, I think, today, still. It turns out I know a little bit more about the first case I described than I did when I wrote the book, because I've read a biography of John Wilkes. Does anybody know who John Wilkes was? Does the name suggest anything to you? What? No, because that would have been, then John Wilkes Booth would have been John Booth Wilkes, right? No, John Wilkes is the person John Wilkes Booth was named after. John Wilkes is also arguably the source of the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. John Wilkes was this fascinating, crazy journalist politician in 18th century England who fought a private war with the King of England and won. And he was a very able journalist. He was irresponsible, charismatic, brilliant. He was purportedly the ugliest man in England, and he claimed that with 30 minutes to talk away his face, he could defeat the handsomest man in England in the contest for a lady's favors. And he was at various points in his life an outlaw in Europe because he was wanted for a rather dubious criminal charge in England, a prisoner in the Tower of London, Lord Mayor of London. That happened, by the way, after the other two. A member of the House of the House of Commons of Parliament, who was three times in a row, the House refused to seat him after he won an election. The same election. They kept winning it. And the third time, they seated the guy who came in second on the ground that they wouldn't count Wilkes as a legitimate candidate. And years later, the House of Commons erased from its record the fact that it had done that, on the grounds that it was a bad precedent to have the House, in effect, appointing its own members by seating somebody who had lost the election. So a very, very interesting character. But one of the things he did was to publish The North Briton, which is the journal which was the source of this original punitive damage case. And The North Briton was a very strongly anti-government journal published anonymously. And The North Briton had an article which pretty strongly implied, without ever saying, that the king's sort of chief minister and closest friend and ally was the lover of the king's mother. The king's father being dead by this time. He wouldn't be king if his father wasn't dead by this time. And the king and his people were so mad at that they set out the king's messengers, because they were roughly like Secret Service men, basically with a blank warrant. A warrant that authorized them to seize anybody or any materials believed to be associated with this issue of the North Briton. And they seized, among other things, the guy who, I think Wilkes was one of the persons they did something to, but the particular person who led in this case was one of the other people associated with it. And in the course of the litigation, Wilkes successfully persuaded the courts that a blank warrant was invalid under British law. And that's the origin, ultimately, of the Fourth Amendment's requirement that no arrest shall occur except on a warrant specifically described. You will probably remember the language better than I do. So in that sense, Wilkes is the father of the Fourth Amendment. He was pro the revolutionaries in the American Revolution. Some years before that, the colonial legislature of North Carolina, I believe it was, voted a substantial sum as a donation to a fund which was to pay off Wilkes' debts because he was extravagant in general and to help fund his political efforts. The royal government did not approve of this and sent the royal governor of North Carolina instructions to command the legislature to rescind the gift. The legislature refused, and the government of North Carolina shut down for about 2 years as a result of that. So he's just a wonderful character. He marries a somewhat older woman. Unsuccessful marriage. He has a daughter out of it, though, who he's very close to. He separates from his wife. He has various affairs. He lives, I think, with one of his lovers and one of his children by the lover. Later on, there's this wonderful poem he writes to his daughter at some point on her birthday when he says he'd like to give her the best gift a father could give a daughter, his heart, but he can't because she stole it from him long ago. So anyways,
If you want to read some 18th-century history, I recommend the biography of Wilkes. But in any case, that's the origin of this case, because the king's messengers were out to get anybody they thought was responsible for this particular issue of the North Britain. I guess he was a demagogue. He was a very popular figure, which is how he gets elected both to Parliament and Lord Mayor of London. He was popular with the mob rather than the aristocracy, as it were. I first came across him in the memoirs of John Boswell. Boswell, you may know of, is the biographer of Samuel Johnson. But Boswell also spent during a good deal of his life, he kept a diary. And it eventually turned up in the early 20th century. So it was lying somewhere or other and was published. And Boswell politically was on the opposite side from Wilkes, that Boswell was sort of a conservative, royalist, who admired the Middle Ages and so forth. But he liked Wilkes enormously. Wilkes was such a charming person. They were good friends, and Boswell thought very highly of him. That was why I got interested in him when I then a little later read this. All right, so let's get on to punitive damages. And the basic history, which I run through, I think, correctly as far as I know in the chapter, is that they are a very uncommon rule in the 18th century. I don't know of any examples before the 18th century. As late as the 19th century, there is a substantial minority opinion which holds that they don't exist, which holds that what are sometimes called punitive, exemplary, I think there are a couple of other terms that are used for that, namely damages substantially larger than the damage done, is just a misunderstanding, and that really it's damages for non-pecuniary injuries or for not easily obvious injuries, for injuries to dignity and reputation and stuff like that. And it's only in the 20th and then early 21st century that you move to a point where it's fairly common to have three punitive damages together. And I then run through what I think are about six different possible explanations for punitive damages. The first one is they aren't there. That's the one I already mentioned. That is, they're a misunderstanding for damages for other things. The second is that they're a way of expressing moral disapproval. And the third and the fourth are two different ones by Landis and Posner. One of them is their probability multiplier. All right, we've already seen why there's an argument for having probability multipliers. For say, if we have a kind of tort which often is not successfully prosecuted, we should have a higher damage payment when it is to deter it. And the problem is that it's very unclear that the criteria for punitive damages would match at all well with torts of that sort. The next requirement they have, which is a little more plausible, is why do we worry about over-deterrence? We worry about too much punishment only if we're afraid it'll deter some offenses that ought to occur. So if there are categories where we are pretty confident the optimal level of offenses is zero, then we can raise the punishment as high as we feel like it. That ignores the cost of punishment, but they aren't considering that there. And if we're not sure how much damage is done, let's add some extra just to play safe. So that's their argument. And I then have my two arguments, one of which is the one that is implicit in what I was saying a few minutes ago about punishment costs, that you have punitive damages for those offenses that you think are easy to deter, because by raising the punishment above the damage done, you deter more offenses and thus reduce the total cost of litigating them. And then my favorite one, because it's much more fun, which is the one that ultimately takes us back to my barroom bully story, hawk dove equilibrium and all of that, which is that there are strategic torts where the reason that I am beating you up is to deter him and him and him and him from doing things I don't like. And if there's a strategic tort, and if tort ordinary damages don't really fully compensate, so the people don't want to be beaten up and then sue, then the ordinary damages won't adequately deter, because the benefit to me is not just the benefit of beating you up, but of deterring him and him and him. That's a cost to them, but that's not showing up in the damages, and therefore we have the higher punishment in order to deter strategic torts. And that's, I don't know if it's right, but I think it's a more ingenious argument than the other one, so I like it better. I guess I regard economics in part as an art form. Maybe theorizing in general in part as an art form. And, you know, unless you have questions, I'm not sure I have anything beyond what's in the chapter and what I've just run over. All right. Well, we can finish this Wednesday. With luck.